From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
More charges of politics at the Bush Department of Justice. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Alabama's former governor is doing 7 years in a federal prison. Democrats in Congress are investigating his prosecution and his conviction. 44 former state attorneys general, including Republicans, say irregularities in the case raise questions about basic fairness. On To the Point, Alabama is in an uproar over a case that could have national implications. Has the Bush administration used the power of prosecution to influence elections? Are the Democrats misusing their power to conduct investigations? On Reporter's Notebook later on, new video games for old people. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Alabama's former governor sits in a federal prison while Washington Democrats raise questions about political prosecutions. On To the Point, we'll hear the latest bitter dispute about politics and the Bush Department of Justice. On Reporter's Notebook, Baby Boomers Take Note, Brain Exercises may help fight Alzheimer's disease. First, this news update. Russia today announced testing of what it calls the father of all bombs, as President Putin dropped a political bombshell. He replaced Prime Minister Mikhail Fradkov with a virtual unknown, financial crime investigator Viktor Zubkov. Fred Weir reports from Moscow for the Christian Science Monitor. And Fred, good to have you back with us.
My pleasure.
Let's talk politics first. How important is the Prime Minister if President Putin can replace him at will?
Well, of course, it's a one-man political system, and even more so in the 7 years since Putin's been president, he has really reinforced the autocratic nature of the system. However, according to the Russian Constitution, Prime Minister is next in line. So if anything happened to Putin, the Prime Minister would step into the president's shoes.
What about the elections soon to arise? Does this mean that Mr. Putin will endorse Viktor Zubkov?
Well, no. As I said, everything depends on Putin in this system, and he's clearly out to keep us guessing. He must have some sort of an end game in mind for stepping down, as he has repeatedly said he will when his second term expires early next year. But what that is hard to say. The way he came to power, if everyone remembers, is that he was appointed prime minister by Boris Yeltsin almost exactly 8 years ago. And when Yeltsin resigned suddenly on New Year's Eve, Putin became acting president and took it from there. Now, it's possible he has a similar sort of scenario in mind and that Zubkov is the dark horse that Putin has chosen. But it's equally possible that Zubkov is just a red herring, or there's some other reason that this relative unknown technocrat has been put into this job suddenly today.
Talk with Fred Weir, a Kremlin watcher in Moscow for the Christian Science Monitor. Well, what about the father of all bombs?
Well, this is a huge bomb. It's what they call a fuel-air explosive, you know, or a vacuum bomb. It's a bomb that's dropped from an airplane on a parachute, and at a certain point above the ground, it releases a cloud of incendiary gas, like gasoline or napalm or something like that, and then ignites it and creates a huge fireball of the kind that can only be compared to a nuclear fireball, and is almost as destructive. Now, this is not a brand new type of weapon. The United States has fuel-air explosives and tested a big one about 4 years ago. But the Russians claim that they have really improved on this process, that their bomb is smaller in size and four times more powerful than the American one.
So the American one was the mother of all bombs. This now is being called the father of all bombs by the Russians. How does it play into Russian politics and international diplomacy?
Yes, in itself, I don't think it's such a big deal. But when you take it together with a lot of developments, Russia has announced a huge rearmament program. Putin recently ordered the resumption of Cold War bomber patrols into NATO territory. These sorts of things, even though the testing of this bomb is a bit of theater in some way, it can't help but sort of ratchet up the feeling that we're headed to, if not a new Cold War, certainly a more jittery sort of world.
A more jittery sort of world, certainly as long as Mr. Putin is the president, but once again, we don't know how long that's going to be.
No, I mean, we just don't know what his plans are for the succession, and they're clearly this move he made today is some kind of a part of his end game, but we will have to wait to see, you know, what comes next.
There certainly are potential candidates to run for president. We don't have to; it wouldn't have to be necessarily that the prime minister, even if he is Mr. Putin's choice, would be unopposed.
I think pretty much whoever Putin, you know, gives the nod to, is the person who will be the next president. The system in Russia has become so narrowed down, so tightly controlled, that yes, there will be a sort of a multi-party election to anoint the next president, but I don't think it will be truly competitive.
In any case, Mr. Putin himself is prohibited from the Constitution from running again. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but he has repeatedly said that he will leave, and this is the main thing to watch, because he could change the Constitution. He has more than enough control over the levers to easily do that, but he has made a huge point of saying over and over again that he's going when his second term expires, and at some point you have to take the guy at his word.
Okay, well, we will see what happens, of course. In the meantime, Fred Weir with the Christian Science Monitor in Moscow. Many thanks.
Thank you.
In a moment, the latest allegations that the Bush Department of Justice has played politics with the power of prosecution on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. 2 months ago, Alabama's former Democratic Governor Don Siegelman was sentenced to 7 years in a federal prison for bribery and obstruction of justice. He was immediately shackled and denied release on bail pending appeal. He did not even get the usual 45 days to put his affairs in order. 44 former state attorneys general, including Republicans, have asked Congress to investigate what they call irregularities that they say question the basic fairness that is the linchpin of our system of justice. The New York Times says the case could become the centerpiece of a Democratic effort to show that the Justice Department engaged in political prosecutions. Laura McGann is following the story for TP Muckraker. That's a sister blog to TalkingPointsMemo.com. And Laura McGann, we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
What are some of these irregularities that the attorneys general are worried about, in addition to the fact that it appeared the former governor was kind of rushed off to prison?
Well, the story really picked up controversy about 3 months ago or 4 months ago in late spring when a Republican lawyer in Alabama released an affidavit showing that she had evidence that perhaps the case was politically motivated and pursued because of a sort of a Republican vendetta, possibly, in Alabama.
A Republican vendetta, which was timed according to elections, is that correct?
Right. So the Republican lawyer in Alabama named Dana Jilsonson was working on the gubernatorial election in 2002. And she has said that she recalls a conversation with several other Republicans right after the election in 2002 when it was hotly contested. And she recalls discussing with these other Republicans working for Don Siegelman's opponent, talking about how to get Don Siegelman to back down from contesting the election. And during that conversation, she recalls one Republican on the call with ties to Karl Rove suggesting that he would have his wife, who is the U.S. attorney, or a U.S. attorney in Alabama, pursue Siegelman. And he also she also recounts how she heard this Republican say that he had spoken with Karl Rove about having the Justice Department go after Siegelman. So she became sort of this spark for the controversy that is now in the news.
So Jill Simpson is the Alabama lawyer. She was a Republican operative, claims that during a telephone call, she heard another operative whose wife was the U.S. attorney say that they were going to make things difficult for the governor and that Karl Rove had something to do with it.
Right.
How have the Republicans responded to that?
Well, the only real comment, well, there's been, it's been addressed in a few ways. The Republicans in Alabama obviously have said that this case was based on Don Siegelman's corrupt behavior, that they prosecuted him because he was corrupt, that the prosecutors there prosecuted him on legit charges, and that he was convicted by a jury and sentenced accordingly. As far as Karl Rove's response, there's only been one denial made, just a small comment made one time in Alabama. But in terms of the response from the Justice Department, it's becoming more tangled. It's been more of a struggle because now the House Judiciary Committee has requested documents, and the Department of Justice has said they won't release those documents to the House Judiciary Committee. So it's been different responses from different facets of the prosecution from Alabama to the actual Department of Justice in Washington.
And Jill Simpson, this Republican lawyer who says she overheard this conversation or was part of this conversation on a conference call, is on her way to Washington. She's going to testify under oath on Friday to that House Judiciary Committee.
Right. So she is having a private meeting with staff members about what she knows. She hasn't released a statement about what exactly she'll be saying, but as far as I know, she'll be bringing documents and some evidence with her, and will answer questions from a panel of both Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, so that's one kind of irregularity that the 44 former attorneys general are pointing to. There are also issues, are there not, about the charges that were brought against Mr. Siegelman, many of which were dismissed. And the ones that he was convicted on seem to be problematic, according to some people, particularly the bribery charge. Tell us about that.
Don Siegelman was charged with more than 20 charges brought, and he was convicted on 7 counts. And those 7 counts are related to one alleged scheme where he appointed a healthcare executive to a hospital board in exchange for a donation to a state lottery fund. It was a project of Don Siegelman. So the question, the irregularity there that some experts have pointed to is saying that this is not a typical bribery case where a politician received money into his own pocket in exchange for a favor, that the person who made the alleged bribe did get this seat, but the money went to the lottery fund rather than Siegelman himself. So even though it was 7 charges, it was one event that spurred those 7 charges.
And there are those who contend that that's business as usual at every state capitol and in Washington, that people who get appointed to boards may be contributors to various causes, although not directly to the person that appoints them. Is that right?
Right. And in this instance, too, Richard Scrushy, who was the healthcare executive who was appointed to the hospital board, had already held that position, and this would be a renewal of that seat. So the actual favor that he received doesn't look as fishy as other instances of of corruption or bribery, and that has been one of the points of contention for people who think that Don Siegelman was unfairly prosecuted.
Now, the government asked for a 30-year prison sentence, which would be extraordinary for such cases. He was given a 7-year sentence. The attorneys general seem to think even that is pretty long. How does it compare to other kinds of sentences in federal courts in Alabama?
You know, I don't want to speak to that specifically. I know that has been, you know, I can't say what typically the average length would be for a case like this, but the talk has been that this is an exceptionally long sentence.
Mm-hmm.
for this type of a case. Especially the 30 years was highly unusual that the prosecution was even seeking that at the time. But the 7 years has been cited as an example of how Siegelman has been treated differently than other officials who've been prosecuted in the past.
There's also another charge that he was convicted on has something to do with the sale of a motorcycle. Is that correct?
Right. I think the main corruption charge had to do with the hospital board situation, but there was a separate instance having to do with selling a motorcycle that I actually, it hasn't really been the focus of discussion, so I guess I shouldn't speak to the details on that, just because I'm not as familiar with that.
Sure. Okay. Again, Laura McGann is Washington-based reporter for TPM Muckraker. That's a sister publication to TalkingPointsMemo.com. The Department of Justice, with the acting United States Attorney Louis Franklin, not one of those involved in the phone conversation, has issued a statement saying that the investigation was precipitated by the investigation of the former governor by an investigative reporter, Eddie Curran, who works for the Mobile Press Register. He joins us now. And Eddie Curran, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, so the question has been raised by 44 attorneys general, former attorneys general, some of them Republicans. The investigation is going on in Washington about the evidence against the former governor. What about that evidence? Is it stretching the idea of bribery to say that if somebody contributed to a fund that had to do with a lottery and a campaign to get a new lottery for education, was then appointed to a board, that could be bribery when the governor himself didn't get any money?
Okay. Well, first of all, I say that the 44 attorneys general were part of a group that Siegelman has been visiting every year, paid for by Alabama taxpayers. They're mostly his friends, really. So it's not, I wouldn't describe them as an entirely independent body.
Even though some of them are Republicans.
Yeah, there's a guy named Grant Woods. And, you know, I do think this in this whole situation, the Republican v. Democrat thing is being overplayed. But that's just my opinion. But
sure.
I'll quickly get into how this thing started is, well, I did a story in April 2001 about a warehouse project that was awarded to a company called GH Construction that was secretly owned by a guy named Lanny Young, who was a lobbyist and political consultant for Waste Management. Lanny had been the roommate of Siegelman's chief of staff, and it came out he gave money to Siegelman, to Siegelman's chief of staff in the neighborhood of $50,000, and to Nick Bailey, who was Siegelman's budget officer, but really Siegelman's driver and constant companion. So Lanny was given this contract to build a $20 million warehouse project, but in looking into it, I found that before it even started, he had submitted forged bills that the state had paid, and so 2 days after that, the investigation commenced, and Don Siegelman personally thanked me for writing these articles. The $20 million bond issue was canceled prior to us even writing the first story.
Okay, so he thanked you for that. Now he's the guy that's in jail, in part as a result of other stories that you did.
Yeah. Let me say one thing about the bribery statutes that we're dealing with as I understand them. Okay, some of the things that he was not prosecuted for, such as selling his home for twice its value to a straw man acting on behalf of trial lawyer Lanny Vines, or the $1.4 million that he received in legal fees as governor without doing anything. One reason, the bribery statute, as I understand, if I go to you and I give you $1 million and you're the governor, okay, I give it to you, not as a campaign contribution, just put it in your bank account, okay, I put it on my taxes, maybe you put it on your taxes, and we don't have a discussion. 2 months later, you call, say, can I have some state business? You give it to me. No crime, okay, because you can't prove the quid pro quo. Now, if I go to you and I say, I want this contract, and you, the governor, say, the only way you're going to get it is to give me a $5 campaign contribution. That is a quid pro quo. That's the way the law is. And it's so really, some things that say it's just a campaign contribution, well, that's the way the law is. But let me tell you about this particular campaign contribution, okay? Campaign contributions are disclosed publicly, correctly? Correct?
Okay.
And this foundation was formed. Siegelman had based his entire career on it. I mean, I have things where he's saying the future of your political career, and his only career was political, was passage of this lottery. Okay, he formed a foundation which had to file 990s to the IRS to disclose everything and disclose contributions with the state. Okay, well, 2 years after the lottery lost and it was dissolved, I came across a small donation to the Lottery Foundation. I told my editor, this doesn't make any sense. It's like a donation to George Wallace. He's dead. Why was somebody giving the Lottery Foundation money after it was dissolved? Okay? So I spent 6 months and had to write about 11 stories finding out why this was.
Was this the donation from Richard Scrushy? This was a different donation?
This was a $13,000 donation.
You haven't gotten to the things that Siegelman was convicted of yet.
Well, this is what I had to do to find it. They didn't disclose it to the state. They filed 990s that were fraudulent. They didn't list the $500,000, and it was two $250,000 donations. One of them was not from HealthSouth. It was from a Maryland company called Integrated Health Services, which was a month away from going bankrupt. What happened was...
Wait a minute. I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought and hope we can get back to the issues that actually got the governor jailed as we continue to talk about this. We'll also hear another side of this from somebody who thinks that Mr. Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, was railroaded by the Bush Justice Department. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, we'll hear about computer games and other devices to keep brains healthy and fight the mental declines that come with aging. Baby boomers, take note. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Once again, Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, is in jail on a 7-year sentence for bribery and other forms of corruption, convicted of 7 of 20 charges that were made against him by federal prosecutors at the instigation, obviously, of the Bush administration and the in Washington. We've just been listening to Eddie Curran, reporter for the Mobile Press Register, whose reports were in part responsible for starting the investigation of the governor. There are those who believe, as I indicated earlier, that this was a political prosecution. One of those is Scott Horton. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, contributor to Harper's Magazine, and writer of the No Comment blog on the Harper's website. Scott Horton, good to have you with us.
Great to be back.
Tell us, if you can, as briefly as possible, because this gets long and complicated, and we heard a lot about contracts and other things that weren't directly related to the conviction of the governor. Why do you think this was political?
Well, I think it's a question of exercise of prosecutorial discretion to bring claims in the area of campaign finance and fundraising and distribute the political benefices. And the key question is, if you fix a rule in interpreting the statutes, are you applying the same rule consistently with respect to everybody? And the answer you get here very clearly is a resounding no. In fact, I interviewed more than a dozen federal prosecutors who'd handled corruption cases. They all told me the same thing, which is that no federal prosecutor exercising independent discretion ever would have brought these charges against Governor Siegelman. And the key point here is going back to the focus of personal benefit. The key indicator in a prosecutor deciding whether to proceed is whether that politician, figuratively speaking, is putting money in his pocket. So if money is being raised to support a public purpose, as in this case, public finance for education via a lottery, that's an entirely different thing from a politician gaining personally. And so here we see a twisting, a warping of the rule. We see it being applied in a way that has not been applied against other political figures, particularly here against Republicans. In fact, we go back and look at all the things that Eddie Curran was just talking about. For instance, he talked about lots of things that didn't figure in the trial, which I think is typical because what's in the trial is so weak. But he talked about the fact that Siegelman received compensation from his law practice while he was governor. Well, Dick Cheney receives more today, every year, from Halliburton Corporation than he gets from the federal treasury, and that upsets a lot of people, but it's not illegal and it's not corrupt. Similarly, politicians all the time go out and raise funds to retire debts from old political campaigns. They also go out all the time and raise funds for public interest projects and for philanthropies. That's not viewed, or was not before this prosecution, viewed as corrupt. And if we look at the distribution of benefices of public offices by political people, you don't need to look any further, frankly, than the Bush-Cheney campaign, which in two elections organized a preferred arrangement for campaign contributors who paid more than $100,000, who were known as pioneers and rangers, those who gave even more, with a clear understanding to all those people who gave this money that you put your money in, and if you want an ambassadorial or similar appointment, it's yours. The president's going to give it to you. That's exactly the same sort of thing that we see going on in Alabama. Is it disturbing? Damn right it's disturbing. Does the Justice Department go ahead and prosecute these things? Absolutely not.
What about the relationship of the prosecution, the timing of it, to the political system in Alabama, and particularly to the election? Are you alleging they were trying to influence elections?
No question about it. That's what drove it. In fact, I first was keyed into this by two things, by information I received from a figure in the Republican Party of Alabama, and then by hearing about Jill Simpson's allegations. And I've had more than 100 hours of interviews with Ms. Simpson. I've looked at lots of documents, and I can tell you what's on the public record now is the tiniest tip of the iceberg. There's vastly more information and material than has come out so far. It's not just a question of one supposedly overheard, but it really wasn't overheard, one conversation she participated in with William Canary. There are a whole series of other conversations and dealings over a long period of time. And if we look now at the department, I tell you one thing, a lot of people in the Judiciary Committee of the House were absolutely astonished at the letter that came from the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General responding to their request, because it was filled with a long series of documentably false statements concerning the case. A lot of false statements concerning Simpson and her dealings, but then it goes on to say how the decision was made to prosecute. It says this was handled and brought from the beginning by professional career prosecutors. That is not true, and that's one of the things that's about to emerge.
Well, wasn't the case prosecuted by Lewis Franklin, in fact? Isn't he a career prosecutor?
Lewis Franklin handled the in-court presentation of the proceedings with a lawyer from the Public Integrity section right next to him. But if you go back and look at the entire history of this case, remember, it was first brought, the first prosecution was brought by Alice Martin, U.S. Attorney in the Northern District of Alabama, a woman now under investigation for perjury, a very serious case of perjury, in fact. And that case wound up being blown out of the water by UW Clemmon, chief judge in the Northern District, who pretty openly questioned the political motivation of the case. In fact, it was very, very thin gruel from the beginning. And the Justice Department, instead of dropping it, moves to a different district in order to handpick a different judge. And this time, it is the wife of William Canary, kingpin in the Republican Party in Alabama, close friend of Karl Rove, who brings the prosecution. She initiates it. She says that she withdrew, that she recused herself. I challenge you to find the recusal papers in the file.
Okay.
Not there. And then I think if you look, she's giving interviews about this constantly. She's involved. But beyond that, you're going to see a lot more information coming out in the next month about the decisions that went on within the Justice Department and beyond. And you'll see it's at the pinnacle of political appointments, and the Justice Department and beyond is the place where these decisions were taken.
All right. More details in this case, I think, and on this program than our listeners are going to be able to keep track of. Jill Simpson, once again, is the Republican operative, an attorney who's given an affidavit that says she was part of a conversation where William Canary, the Republican operative in Alabama, whose wife was the attorney general, the U.S. attorney, said that the governor was going to be dealt with, taken care of prior to the fact to his prosecution. Just to get everybody straight here, that's part of the fact situation that the House Judiciary Committee is looking at. Eddie Curran, quickly back to you. You don't agree, I take it, that this was a political prosecution. Can you explain that without resorting to all of these various different cases and incidents?
Well, one problem with this case is it's so complicated that to try to actually, you know, to negate some of this stuff, you have to go into the detail, but I'm not going to do that. Basically, what this has turned, they're trying to turn Don Sigma into Nelson Mandela. And Scott Horton has written things comparing, he has alleged that my paper and the Birmingham News, because we are both owned by Newhouse, were part of a conspiracy to get Don Sigma. The fact is, that's an insult to my editors, to me, and the truth is, I compete like dogs with the Birmingham News, but Scott Horton has written as if it's just fact. The New York Times has, well, let me just say one thing about Jill Simpson. Let's imagine this is Mayberry, okay? And I'm with the Mayberry News, so I'm easy to make fun of. We're just a little Alabama media, okay? We've written stories about the Mayberry mayor, and these outsiders come in and they talk to someone who says it's all political. Turns out they've been talking to Otis and Ernest T. Bass. Jill Simpson, whoever she is, was one in business with a Democratic operative who didn't get a contract through the Riley administration. Second, she was lastly a backer of Roy Moore, the Ten Commandments judge, and to be a backer of Roy Moore, you almost have to be insane, okay? So Jill Simpson, who is this person who they're pinning this whole thing on, is of questionable authenticity. I mean, I hope they have a hearing, and I hope they have her, and I hope they put Lewis Franklin up, and I hope they put Steve Fague up. You know, Steve Fague is the one that prosecuted Guy Hunt, the Republican. Everybody's always thought Steve was a Republican, a Democratic hit, you know, going after
Democrats. I think we're learning more about Alabama politics than we can possibly absorb here in the amount of time that we have left. Scott Horton, let me go back to you. Are you, in fact, an outsider coming into Alabama and making outrageous claims, particularly with regard to the newspapers and Mr. Curran's employees? He says he's insulted by that.
Well, since my family moved to Alabama in 1829 and has been in Lawrence County ever since, I'll trade charges about who's the carpetbagger here with my friend Eddie down in Mobile. I'm from the northern part of the state. But beyond that, it's completely characteristic here that you see Eddie goes on the defense and he just engages in a series of ad hominem attacks on people against Jill Simpson, who he disparages without going into any details, making false statements. Jill Simpson is a contracts attorney. That's what she does. So, of course, she's had clients who failed to get contracts. That's a completely meaningless statement. She's been deeply involved in Alabama politics and was involved as a supporter of Governor Riley's campaign, which is how all this came back. I criticized Eddie Curran specifically and a colleague of his at the Birmingham News. I said they tag-teamed reporting this incident from the beginning, pushing very aggressively allegations against Governor Siegelman, which were not backed up. And what you'll find in their reports from the beginning is the interior content of the prosecution's portfolio, including grand jury materials, which constitutes poisoning the well, not the way our system is supposed to run, and not the sort of objective, detached reporting that citizens of Alabama have a right to expect of their newspapers.
Okay,
I think they're really fine newspapers in Alabama, but not these two.
Let me let Eddie Curran respond to that.
Well,
go ahead.
The funny thing is, I wrote the stories that the prosecution were based on. There was no prosecution going on when I wrote my stories, okay? After I did my first stories that led to the investigation, the FBI called me and woke me up and said, "We're coming down to Mobile. We want to talk to you." I said, "Okay." Then I went to my work, my editor, and I said, "We shouldn't do this, should we?" I had to call them back and say, "No, I can't work with you." Brett Blackledge, the reporter that he's talking about, who incidentally won a Pulitzer this past year on other reporting, is not my colleague, he is my competitor, okay? He has said he has read my stories. I dare him to read my stories and point out I have to back up everything I do with public record, okay? And Cy Newhouse, the idea that the Newhouse chain got myself and the Birmingham News and all our editors together to beat up on Don Siegelman is so false.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that because there's just too much detail here, I think, for us to assume. This is only one case. There are others where the Bush Justice Department has been accused of using prosecutorial power in order to influence a political situation. One of them comes in Wisconsin, where a judge has thrown out charges against a woman, an appellate court, a federal appellate court, threw out charges after the woman was imprisoned. Scott Horton, very briefly, can you summarize that one?
Of allegations of corruption relating to the contract process. In this case, a contract was awarded to the low bidder, and a prosecution was begun against Georgia Thompson because that bidder had close ties and then made contributions to the Democratic campaign, the campaign of the Democratic governor. That prosecution figured very prominently in the election for the governorship. And it resulted in the conviction of Georgia Thompson. The matter then went up to the Seventh Circuit, where in an extraordinary event, at the oral presentation of argument, the judges recessed and ordered the immediate release of Georgia Thompson, and then they issued subsequently a scathing opinion. And this is a panel consisting of three prominent conservative Republican judges. They issued an opinion in which the key word really was outrageous.
Okay, we're going to have to once again leave it at that. The Judiciary Committee, Judiciary Committee of the House, again, is investigating the situation in Alabama. Once more, the New York Times and other journalistic institutions are saying that this may become the basis of a new Democratic move against the Bush administration to demonstrate that it is engaged in political prosecutions. We will see, of course, what happens. Obviously, the situation in Alabama, very, very controversial. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School, a blogger at Harper's Magazine. Thanks to you. Thanks to Eddie Curran with the Mobile Press Register and our earlier guest, Laura McGann, at TPM Muckraker, sister blog to TalkingPointsMemo.com. New research suggests that the human brain can sprout new cells, and rewire existing ones late in life. That has created a movement for brain health and a new industry to support it. We'll hear how entrepreneurs are marketing brain exercises to the baby boom generation in a moment on To The Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Norman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Physical exercise, fresh fruits and vegetables, and social activities have long been prescribed for people 65 and older, said to be good for the brain. That's a population, I should add, that will have doubled between the years 2000 and 2030. Now, a fourth activity has been added to defend the brain against age and disease, and that is exercise for the brain itself. Michael Marzenek is professor of integrative neurosciences at the University of California at San Francisco. He's co-founder of the Scientific Learning Corporation in Oakland and Posit Science in San Francisco. Those are two companies creating brain training computer software. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
That's very nice to be with you, Warren.
Tell us about the basis of this. How are these video games designed to deal with dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
Well, there's a long history, Warren, of the study of the brain as and how it changes as you learn.
And basically the principle is to drive the brain to change in ways that correct it, or you could say drive it in corrective or strengthening or rejuvenating directions, to help an individual strengthen or overcome deficits that apply in aging, or that it might apply or be parallel with an ongoing progressive illness.
So what's the mechanism? How does it work? How does the brain deteriorate? How can you make it better?
Well, first of all, when you learn, as you acquire new skills and abilities, the brain is plastic, and it's plastic throughout life, and it actually changes in its connectional detail throughout life. And basically that those changes, that revision in its detailed wiring is the basis of that development of that new skill or ability. And the whole principle is to try to drive the brain in a corrective direction, you could say, to make it operate in a more normal way, or to make it operate in a way that would apply to the functional characteristics of a younger brain. And basically what happens in an older brain, as an example, is that basically physical changes occur because the processes in the brain become noisier, the representation of information and processing in the brain is less sharp, it's slower. It changes in a variety of ways plastically in an adjustment to how the brain changes as the brain ages. And you can always improve its functionality by aggressively attacking it with intensive learning.
Is there a direct evidence that the kinds of software that you are developing and others are developing as well, in fact, has the effect, the positive effect that you're suggesting?
Well, we've run controlled trials and demonstrated that in those experiments we not only drive improvements in the skills that we specifically train people with, but those improvements generalize to the person's everyday life, to improvements of their memory, their cognitive abilities, and so forth. So, and we're doing increasingly sophisticated trials that also show that we actually change the physical and functional brain. So now you can image the brain, you can record longitudinally, you can show it in its relatively impaired state before you train, or maybe shows all of the characteristics of an older brain that's slowed down and sluggish and imprecise. And then you can train the brain and you can actually show that it's physically and functionally improved itself.
Again, Michael Merzenich is professor of integrative neurosciences at the University of California at San Francisco and co-founder of two corporations dealing with companies creating brain training video games. Come back to him in a moment. First, let's go to Andrew Carl. He's also a professor, director of the Assisted Living Senior Housing Administration at George Mason University, and he studies brain training products as well. Recently became a spokesperson for Nintendo Brain Age 2. Professor Carl, good to have you with us.
Yeah, hi, Warren. Hi, glad to be here.
Describe Brain Age 2 and some of the other kinds of things that we're talking about here. What do they look like? How do they work?
Well, I mean, Brain Age 2 and Posit Science, you know, what I like about them is you know, they're all grounded in neuroscience. It's what's nice about them is there's a nice continuum out there, you know, from handheld games to computer-based games like Posit, or trainers, I should call them, like Posit Science and MindFit. But the neuroscience behind them is fairly much the same. You know, we're focusing on basic things, you know, accuracy, your ability to concentrate and focus on things. And that has to do with your short-term memory. You know, we can remember things from 50 years ago, but we don't remember from 5 minutes ago. And that's really about your concentration and focus. We look at things like speed of processing and your communication skills. You know, a lot of times when you say something to a senior and they say, huh, it's not because they didn't hear you. It's because they're kind of processing what they just heard a little bit more slowly. Or audio skills like that Posit focuses on so well, where, you know, essentially our brains just kind of get lazy in our listening skills as we age, and we need to go back to work on our listening skills and then also visual skills, reaction time, periphery skills, our ability to take what we see with our eyes, send it to our brain and process it quickly. And that's what, you know, all of these brain trainers are kind of focusing on, these very basic areas, doing it in different ways and across a variety of products.
Now, baby boomers, having seen their own parents go through the process of aging, are now looking forward to doing it themselves. Once again, they're going to be an enormous cohort of the population very soon. I guess they already are. What kind of a market does that create?
Well, it's a huge market. I mean, you've got 78 million baby boomers. I'm one of them. You know, one of us is turning 60 years old about every 8 seconds in the United States. And I think what you just said a minute ago when it comes to cognitive training, It's really hitting home with us because we have older parents. You know, we have parents that we're taking care of who are 80 or 85. Nearly half of everyone over the age of 85 is either experiencing Alzheimer's or a related form of dementia. So we're seeing it on a very personal level every day in our own lives. We're becoming much more aware of it, and as we become aware of it, and just because of, you know, the size, the critical mass we represent, companies are rightfully going to step up and try to address, you know, consumer wants.
Professor Mike Merzenek, once again at the University of California, Andrew Carl at George Mason University. Let me go back to Professor Merzenek at the University of California at San Francisco. How do you make how do you get older people, particularly if their brains are obviously impaired in some way, to pay attention to this, to actually play the games?
Well, one of the things that you have to worry about, Warren, in an older individual is you have to make exercises that really engage them. And one of the purposes of that is you're actually trying to improve the machinery of the brain. You're trying to exercise the machinery of the brain that basically controls their motivation, that controls their joy in life, that makes things fun for them again, because that machinery actually is contributing to their learning rates. It's actually contributing to their performance abilities as they learn and remember. So that's a critical thing that's down has taken a downturn in older life. And one of the first things you have to do is to reactivate that machinery and make them alive and lively again. And then you have to engage them to improve and refine their ability. And you do this by making the exercises in a strong self-help and in a strong game-like setting. And then it's fun for people. Basically, it's like going to the gym and with fun in a fun exercise motif, you know, where people really enjoy it. They look forward to it. They want to do it. They realize it's helping them.
Can you describe one of the games that we're talking about and make it sound interesting enough that somebody's parents might want to use it?
Well, they make judgments about things that are important because there's also an intensity to it. It's serious business. It's, in our case, we're trying to drive the brain in a serious motivated setting, because under those conditions we know we drive improvements the fastest, and we know that's what's really required to drive them significantly in a corrective direction. But we try to make them continuously rewarding, and we try to make them, as in any game, and video-like game, and we also try to make it clear to the individual that what they are doing is contributing to their progressive advance and improvement. They basically contract their advance and improvement as they progress. And that's true in most of the well-designed exercises and games that are being provided to older people.
Andrew Carl, back to you. Let me try this again. Can you describe specifically what one of these games looks like and how it might look to an older person asked to play it?
Well, first of all, I agree completely with Dr. Merzenek. You know, I call it functional engagement. So regardless of what they look like, you know, you have to be able to functionally engage individuals, and in this case, older adults who may or may not have a comfort level with computers. So you've got to be able to put something in their hands or in front of them that they're going to have a comfort level to, you know, log on and begin to work on. And Posit Science, by the way, does a really nice job of that. You put on the headphones and you need a mouse, and that's about it once you're set up. The Nintendo's a handheld game that you use a little stylus plastic pen to tap the screen or write on the screen in your own handwriting. To engage yourself in a lot of the training exercises that they put you through. So you're not, you know, using a keyboard or even a mouse in this case. You're literally writing words or drawing pictures or numbers in your own handwriting, which it'll recognize. And some of them you talk to the devices. In the case of the Brain Age 2, we'll ask you to speak to the device. So if we can make these trainers, you know, easy to use, and really get you involved again in what I call functional engagement. And as Dr. Merzenek said, you know, keep them interesting, keep them entertaining, keep them goal-oriented. You know, people will do them. People want to do them. We just need to put things out there that will not be, you know, too frustrating for them to get involved with.
In order to sell them, in order to reach the market, do you have to demonstrate that a given game will, in fact, change the brain in the way we heard Dr. Merzenek describe it a moment ago, so that you can see it impaired at one point and improved in another? Is that what it's going to take to really get the industry going?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of a two-part answer, because on an intuitive level, we all know that this works. I mean, we all know that just as you can exercise your body and take on physical declines, we can exercise our brains and take on cognitive declines. So I think some of it's intuitive, and I think for most people who recognize that, that's not the issue. In terms of the actual science, you know, the products are new, but really the science is not new here. It's hard to do a 10-year study on a product that's only been out 2 years. And so as Dr. Mrazenik said, you know, we have some short-term studies that they've done, some with POSIT. A lot of the science that the Nintendo Brain Age is based on, Dr. Ryuta Kawashima in Japan, is based upon neuroscience studies he's been doing for years. So over time, as these trainers have been out there and people will study them, I think we will see the empirical evidence. But for right now, to answer your question, I think a lot of it's really intuitive.
Okay. Again, Andrew Carl, professor at George Mason University, and spokesperson for Nintendo 2, Mike Mrazenik, professor at the University of California at San Francisco, also engaged in software of the sort we are talking about. Thank you both very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Vanessa Romo and Christian Bordahl, our technical director, Phoebe Zimmerman. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.